fatalities. The southern parts of Gaza, including Rafah and Khan Yunis, were not spared from the regime's attacks, which killed over 24 people on Monday. The new fatalities increased the total death toll from the regime's genocide since October 2023 to over 50,750, with nearly 115,480 others injured. According to the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, the regime has also killed nearly 210 journalists since the onset of its aggression against Gaza. Our Gaza correspondent Motia Abu Musabe joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israeli attacks across the besieged territory. Let's take a listen.
Actually, the last 24 hours were horrifying and bloody for the Palestinian people in all areas of Gaza Strip as a result of the pernicious and non-stop Israeli genocidal attacks that are still waged left, right, and center against the Palestinian people. Since dawn hours till this moment, we are talking about more than 70 Palestinian civilians. Half of them were children, have been completely slaughtered and, as you know, murdered by the Israeli occupation forces. And we are talking about more than 40 Palestinians were killed here in Deir el-Balah city after the Israeli occupation forces launched several brutal and destructive airstrikes targeting the residential buildings here. A fresh massacre unfolded over the past couple of hours in the southern part of Deir el-Balah city after the Israeli warplanes destroyed a populated house there, killing at least 9 Palestinian civilians. 4 out of them were children, in addition to several women. In the meantime, another attack has just taken place in the northern part of Gaza Strip when the Israeli fighter jets destroyed a residential building there, killing 6 Palestinian civilians. And now, as we speak right now, we can hear several bombardments are still booming in the southern part of Gaza Strip. So the Israeli attacks are still ongoing. More Palestinian civilians are still slaughtered and killed by the Israeli occupation forces.
The heads of 6 UN agencies have issued a grave warning on the situation in Gaza. They call for the immediate resumption of the ceasefire in the territory amid a deepening humanitarian crisis. The agencies warned of a severe aid shortage and hunger since Israel resumed its all-out aggression on March the 18th. They said for over a month, no commercial or humanitarian supplies have entered Gaza after Israel blocked the entry of aid trucks. The agencies noted that more than 2.1 million people are trapped, bombed, and starved again, while food, medicine, and fuel and other supplies are piling up behind Gaza's closed crossings. The agencies added that at least 1,000 children were killed or injured during the first week of after the Israeli genocide resumed, which is the highest one-week children death toll in the past year. Describing the humanitarian situation as unprecedented, the UN agencies said the territory is witnessing acts of war in Gaza that show an utter disregard for human life. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets of Tel Aviv in a new anti-regime protest as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with U.S. President Donald Trump in Washington. Protesters slam Netanyahu's policies, including his move to oust the regime's top security and legal officials. They also condemned the resumption of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Families of Israeli captives held in Gaza also joined the protests, urging an end to the war and a deal to ensure the release of the captives. The mass protests followed a weekly demonstration on Saturday in which protesters called on the regime's cabinet to put the captives above other interests. They also urged the regime to stop violating the Gaza ceasefire deal with Hamas. The movement says it will only release the remaining captives in exchange for the release of more Palestinian prisoners, a permanent ceasefire, and Israel's complete pullout from Gaza. The Spanish city of Rota has hosted a rally against the presence of NATO and U.S. military bases there. In the rally, activists condemned Spain's complicity in the Israeli aggression against Gaza, highlighting how the Spanish soil is used for arms shipment to Israel despite the government's promises to stop it. Our correspondent Alberto Garcia reports.
The city of Rota hosts the 37th March Against NATO and U.S. Military Bases, an annual demonstration organized by various social, political, and trade union platforms. This year, the event is dedicated to the Palestinian cause, with the slogan, "For Palestine, Against Imperialism," aiming to show solidarity with Palestine in its fight against occupation and suffering under the Israeli regime's brutal campaign in Gaza.
This protest will not dismantle the bases immediately, but it aims to raise awareness of their role in upholding imperialism, which threatens the freedom and sovereignty of peoples, as seen in Palestine, Iran, Yemen, Lebanon, among others.
In the face of the genocide in Gaza, we denounce the role of the Rota base in facilitating arms shipments to Israel and demand that the Spanish government end this support and cut ties with the Zionist regime.
Rota, along with Morón de la Frontera, is one of two Andalusian cities hosting U.S. military bases, serving as a strategic point for NATO operations in southern Europe. This year, protests have gained significance after discovering that Rota's base is used to ship weapons to Israel, violating Spain's ban on arms transfers to the Israeli regime.
I'm here to raise my voice for humanity, against imperialist wars, military bases like Rota that sustain occupation and the suffering of peoples like the Palestinians. We reject increased military spending and demand that peace, freedom and human rights come first.
I'm in Rota today because I cannot remain indifferent to the Holocaust that the Palestinian people are enduring, a televised genocide that demands a response with our presence in the streets.
Participants in the march demand the closure of U.S. bases and the severing of ties between Spain and the Zionist regime of Israel, which they argue perpetuates imperialism and oppression. The mobilization highlights the link between foreign military presence in Andalusia and the interventionist policies affecting regions like West Asia and Africa.
With Pedro Sánchez's announcement to increase military spending in line with NATO demands, Rota rises up against the U.S. military bases on Spanish soil. This year, the protest echoes loudly, "NATO and bases out, for Palestine against imperialism," a clear denouncement of Spain's complicity in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Alberto Garcia, Rota.
Demonstrations across Pakistan have intensified in condemnation of Israel's genocide. Pakistan-Israeli in solidarity with the oppressed Palestinian people, calling for resilience and resistance in the face of Israeli crimes. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi brings us more in this report from Islamabad.
Amid the relentless Israeli bombardment of Gaza, people across Pakistan are raising their voices in solidarity with the oppressed Palestinian people, demanding that the international community hold Israel accountable for its war crimes.
America. If the U.S., U.K., France, and their Western allies are openly supporting Israel's genocide in Gaza, then why are Islamic states like Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations reluctant to cut ties with those backing the massacre of innocent Palestinians? These nations must unite on a single platform to pressure international powers into holding Israel accountable for its war crimes.
From major cities to smaller towns, men, women, and children took to the streets demanding justice for the victims of Israel's relentless attacks on Gaza.
50,000 people just in almost 1.5 years we've lost in Palestine. So what do you expect from a killer, from an occupier, from a rapist, from a butcher, from committing Holocaust and glorifying it? It's like in the cinemas everywhere. I mean, you open your phone, your laptop, and they're so proud of these war crimes. That means that the world order has totally collapsed. There is no international law. There are no international humanitarian laws. And I think this is the end of this world order. We need to really shake our conscience. And everybody, you don't really have to be a Palestinian or a Muslim or a Kashmiri to come out and raise your voice against this oppression and this barbarism and this brutality.
The protesters condemned not only the scale of destruction in Gaza, but also Israel's repeated violations of ceasefire agreements and international law.
Protests and gatherings in Pakistan against Israeli crimes indicate popular support for the Gaza Strip. and growing public anger over the ongoing genocide by Israeli forces in the besieged Palestinian territory. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
Welcome back. In Damascus, Syrians and Palestinians have joined a public march through the streets of the Syrian capital. They voiced outrage over Israel's aggression against Gaza and southern Syria, reaffirming their commitment to justice and liberation. We have a report.
Led by the grassroots group Syrians Against Occupation, demonstrators gathered in Arnouz Square under the banner, "We Remain on Our Land." The protest honored the martyrs of Gaza and Dara, demanding an immediate end to Israeli attacks and accountability for war crimes.
We came from different camps to tell our people in Gaza and all of Palestine that we stand firm with the resistance. Israel cannot be trusted. It seeks to destroy the Palestinian cause and occupy Syria, but Gaza has already foiled their plans as the people in Dara stood against them.
Marching through the capital streets, the protesters held Syrian and Palestinian flags while chanting for justice and liberation. They called out the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza and condemned the repeated Israeli attacks on southern Syria, including the recent massacre in Dara that left several martyrs and wounded.
We're here in solidarity with our people in Gaza and Dara. The Israeli occupation commits horrific massacres, but we are a people of resistance. We will never accept occupation or betrayal.
The protesters also condemned some Arab states for their silence, normalization efforts, and betrayal of the Palestinian cause. Many denounced the Palestinian Authority for its role in repressing the West Bank resistance, stressing that liberation can only come through unity and continued struggle, not through compromise with the occupier.
Our people in Gaza and the West Bank live under destruction and war, backed by the U.S., along with the silence of Arab states and complicity of the Palestinian Authority. Israel seeks to control everything, including the West Bank and Golan, but resistance will crush its imperial ambitions.
Despite the silence of governments, the people of Damascus are making their voices heard. From Arnouz to Mayad Square, solidarity with Gaza and Dara is loud and clear. Ali Mohammed, Damascus.
Israeli forces and settlers press ahead with violent raids on Palestinian towns and cities across the occupied West Bank, causing more casualties. According to local sources, an Israeli settler ran over a Palestinian child in Huwara town near Nablus before speeding away. The child was taken to hospital for treatment. Meanwhile, the regime's forces stormed the town of Beita south of Nablus, firing volleys of tear gas canisters at its residents, causing several Palestinians to suffocate. Israeli settlers protected by the regime's forces also raided the village of Al-Khair, south of Al-Khalil, injuring four Palestinians, including an elderly woman. Settler violence against Palestinians and their property is a daily occurrence in the West Bank and is rarely prosecuted by Israeli authorities. A recent report revealed that Israeli settlers carried out nearly 400 attacks on Palestinian citizens and their property in the West Bank in January and February 2025. Earlier, we were joined by our West Bank correspondent, Nawa Hamed, for more details on the latest Israeli incursions across the occupied territory. Let's take a listen.
The governor of Tobas, Ahmed al-Assad, have announced that the occupation forces have raided the city from all entrances and imposed a state of a curfew on Tobas until tomorrow, 5 p.m., as announced by the IOF. This incursion, actually a violent incursion with a large military forces, large numbers of vehicles and soldiers have invaded Tobas and has taken, of course, many buildings to be a military outpost and put on snipers on the roofs of the buildings. So now, as Tobas is being raided and is being besieged, Not only in Tubas, the situation was tensive at these hours. While we are speaking, many injuries occurred in the area of Shuhba to the east of Ramallah after clashes between Palestinians and raiding IOF forces to the area. The Israeli settlers' violence and the Israeli settlers' attacks upon Palestinians are actually covered and backed up by IOF forces, which leads all the time, which leads to clashes between Palestinians and IOF forces, and then injuries or killed Palestinians among Palestinians.
The Iranian foreign minister has rejected U.S. President Donald Trump's claim that Tehran and Washington will hold direct talks on Iran's nuclear program. Trump made the allegation on the sidelines of his meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington. In response, Abbas Araghchi reaffirmed in a social media post that the Saturday meeting between Iran and the United States in Oman will be high-level but indirect. He added that negotiations in Oman will be both an opportunity and a test, concluding that the ball is now in America's court. His remarks came after earlier on Monday, Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian said Tehran favors negotiations, but not at any cost. He added that the United States needs to prove that it is truly intending to negotiate, noting that the U.S. cannot threaten Iran every day while calling for negotiations. Pezeshkian stressed that the Islamic Republic will not submit to any humiliation. And that's it for this bulletin. Bye-bye for now.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Palestinians posting on social media say they don't think they will survive Israel's bloody bombardment across the Gaza Strip. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Palestinians are posting final messages and letters of farewell on social media, expressing their fear they will not survive amid the intensity of Israel's carpet bombing of the Gaza Strip. Many Palestinians in Gaza have turned to social media since the start of Israel's onslaught in October 2023 to communicate with one another, document Israeli regime attacks and their daily experiences, and share their thoughts, hopes, and lives with international audiences in a period when media outlets, social media platforms, and arts and education institutions stand accused of censoring information and muzzling freedom of expression related to the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza. Over the past 24 hours, however, posts expressing hopelessness amid the severity and destructiveness of the Zionist regime's attacks and fear that people in Gaza might not survive this time have soared. Recently, the Zionist regime killed at least 112 Palestinians in what has become the deadliest day since Israel resumed its war on the besieged enclave on March 18th. A video posted by Noor, a woman from Gaza, shows an Israeli regime strike on a building nearby amidst an entirely destroyed neighborhood as a woman sobs in the background. The caption reads, "It seems we won't survive this time." Journalist Abdullah Al-Attar from Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip shared this sentence, "It seems that we won't make it this time," which has been widely circulated and reshared. Abu Bakr Ahmed, a football journalist from Deir al-Balah, expressed in a post that the people of Gaza know the world has let them down and thus feel their killing is a matter of time. Several users have also called on the people and global powers to pay attention and speak up for the people of Gaza, facing not only bombing, but also starvation due to Israel's blockade on food and essentials. One Palestinian wrote, "Bombs above, hunger below, Gaza is suffering. How much longer can we endure this? The world must act now." Israel's war on Gaza continues to be supported and funded by its allies, most notably the United States regime. In March, the Donald Trump administration bypassed a normal congressional review to approve a nearly $3 billion arms sales to Israel. Recently, independent U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders attempted to bring forward two joint resolutions of disapproval to block $8.8 billion worth of offensive weapon sales to Israel that were already approved by the Trump administration. Only 15 senators, including Tim Kaine and former presidential hopeful Elizabeth Warren, voted to move forward, and the vote to block the weapons transfers failed. Several users have also used their social media accounts to post a farewell message and prayers in case they should die. Writer and pharmacist from Gaza, Omar Hamad, recently posted a farewell message on X saying that he felt his post did not make a difference. He said, "At first, I was eager, sharing everything my hands could write. But I do not know what you need to see or read to finally rise against all that is happening. Not for our sake, but for your conscience, for your faith, so that you do not struggle with your conscience when you go to sleep. I have never felt death drawing this close to me throughout the entire genocide as I do these days," Hamad wrote in a separate post on April 3rd. Hamza Asharif, a medical doctor at the European Hospital and the Al-Aqsa Hospital, posted on X that bombings are intensifying across all areas of the Gaza Strip and that blood is everywhere. He said, "If I die, I'm not a number. I am a planet in itself. I have dreams and ambitions that I wanted to achieve. Don't forget me in your prayers and keep about me." Last month, an Israeli regime missile targeted and killed 23-year-old Al Jazeera journalist Hossam Shabat in Beis Lahia, just hours after Mohammad Mansour, a correspondent for Palestine Today, was killed in an Israeli regime airstrike which targeted his home. His wife and son were killed alongside him. Hours after Hossam's death, his colleagues posted a message written by Hossam himself, indicating that he had a sense that he would be likely targeted. The 23-year-old Palestinian said, "If you're reading this, it means I have been killed, most likely targeted by the Israeli occupation forces." Hossam's self-written eulogy was reminiscent of renowned Palestinian poet and academic Rafat al-Arir, who was killed in an Israeli regime airstrike in December last year, and whose widely circulated poem, "If I Must Die," became a symbol of hope and resistance amid the Zionist regime's war. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, don't hurt people. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, on Arabi English Radio. And so title is Don't Hurt People, and obviously it's self-explanatory. It's self-explanatory whether we're Muslim or non-Muslim. But obviously the thing is, as Muslims, the bar is set really high for us. This is how we are meant to be conducting ourselves, because it's almost a grievous sin to really break the heart of a believer. And it's so, probably you can think about this, and you'd remember some instances yourself where maybe you've experienced this. So I remember, for example, a dear friend who was just finishing her last year of high school in the first year of Corona, and I had posted something on Instagram and about being kind and, you know, being careful with our words, and she had left me a message just to say how much she appreciated that, and in her voice I could hear that she was just about crying when she left that message. It had really touched her. And then came the explanation when I was speaking to her that someone had said some harsh words to her that morning, and he obviously saw her. And this was just a family member probably snapping or using a slightly harsh word towards her. And these things really can stay with people for the rest of the day. I think that psychology has recently said that your feelings just last a matter of seconds, really. But then the problem is we start to think about it more. And that's why, you know, obviously hurting someone's heart, upsetting them because of that really is very tricky, because they can be upset and feel pain and for a whole day. It could even stay with them. A particularly harsh word could stay with them for months or years and they never forget it. Welcome back to A to Z on RB English Radio. So obviously I'm talking about not hurting people. And look, there's a little anecdote, a story from one of our famous martyrs, Zemnans the Sayyid, who was also concerned to raise children with the same standards that he had for himself. So, for example, he would say to his children, well, don't grill meat in the village, because maybe there's someone in the village who actually smell that beautiful aroma, someone who can't afford meat. And obviously they might, you know, just feel really pained at that, you know, not being able to sort of afford that beautiful meat with that beautiful smell. And he would sort of advise his children, for example, to drive small cars so that they didn't have anything that other people who maybe didn't have the means could desire. And once, I think, it said that he saw one of the children in a car that the Sayyid, thought was too big, and advised his child to get a nice small car just so you don't bother or hurt anyone. And he would, just as I said before, would always say it's impermissible to hurt anyone's heart. And, you know, I think this is something that we can for sure work on a daily basis. And, you know, it happens so easily. For example, we get in a taxi one day, and maybe the driver was trying to contact us, and, you know, maybe we'd come from somewhere, the phone was still on silent, and then, you know, you get in the car and then all of a sudden the taxi driver's snapping. And, you know, some people don't shake it off so easily, and this is really the standard. We need to just sort of be very careful with our tongue, with our words in particular, and obviously with other things. But maybe this could be a little habit that we set ourselves, especially with the month of Ramadan, when that comes, to just think carefully before we speak, and control harsh words. Don't even let them get out of the mouth, basically. So inshallah, this is just a reminder to all of us, and I Look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on IB English Radio, and farewell for today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The United States' interest in Greenland is a microcosm of its broader Arctic strategy. A bid to secure economic interests, project power under the pretext of national security, and counter the growing influence of rival powers in this strategically vital region. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Euronews has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. President Donald Trump has dramatically stepped up efforts to seize control of Greenland by dispatching Vice President J.B. Vance, an Ohio native, to visit the mineral-rich, semi-autonomous territory of Denmark, which the United States has eyed for over 150 years. Addressing U.S. troops at Pituffik Space Base on Greenland's northwestern coast on Friday, 28th of March, J.D. Vance delivered Trump's message unequivocally. He made it clear that the American president's ultimate goal is to claim Greenland for the United States by using force if necessary. J.D. Vance said, "We do not believe that military force will ever be necessary, not so much to sound reassuring as to subtly warn that military action could in fact be an option." This would not be the first time for the United States to send troops to seize Greenland. During the Second World War, the U.S. occupied the island after Germany captured Denmark. In 1949, Washington relinquished its claim on Greenland after Denmark joined the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. While at the U.S. military base, Vice President J.D. Vance took aim at Denmark, a longtime NATO ally, accusing the Nordic Kingdom of failing to adequately protect the island's security. Vance said, "Our message to Denmark is very simple. You have not done a good job by the people of Greenland. You have underinvested in the people of Greenland, and you have underinvested in the security architecture of this incredibly beautiful landmass filled with incredible people. That has to change." J.D. Vance claimed Greenland would be better off partnering with the United States. The rebuke of a long-standing ally came shortly after Greenland formed a broad-based coalition government that excludes hardliners advocating swift independence from Denmark. Greenland was a colony of Denmark from 1721 until 1953, when it became a formal territory under the Danish constitution.
In 2009, the Arctic island gained broad self-governing autonomy, including the right to declare independence through a referendum. A majority of Greenland's 57,000 inhabitants are in favor of independence, but many fear that breaking away from Denmark too soon could expose the island to a new colonial master, the United States of America. Donald Trump is not the first American president to eye Greenland. The idea of acquiring the world's largest island has surfaced multiple times in U.S. history, with notable internal discussions occurring in 1867, 1910, 1946, 1955, and most recently under Donald Trump in 2019 and 2025. Straddling the Arctic Circle between the United States, Russia, and Europe, Greenland holds a unique geopolitical advantage that has drawn Washington's interest for over a century and a half. Donald Trump first made waves with his offer to buy Greenland during his first term in office, but he has taken his desire to own the island to a whole new level since returning to the White House for a second term. Donald Trump said in his congressional address in March, "I think we're going to get it," adding, "one way or the other, we're going to get it." The United States' interest in Greenland is a microcosm of its broader Arctic strategy, a bid to secure economic interests, project power under the pretext of national security, and counter the growing influence of rival powers in this strategically vital region. With tensions already running high, the timing of J.D. Vance's visit to Greenland, just weeks after Greenland's parliamentary elections, has ruffled feathers in both Greenland and Denmark. Relations between Greenland and Denmark have long been strained, as many Greenlanders continue to harbor grievances over colonial-era mistreatment. However, Donald Trump's aggressive push for Greenland has spurred Denmark to improve its ties with the semi-autonomous Arctic island. Before J.D. Vance's arrival, Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen congratulated Greenland's new Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen and his incoming government. She said, "I look forward to close cooperation in an unnecessarily conflict-filled time." Donald Trump sees Greenland, whose capital, Newark, is closer to New York than to Copenhagen, as a key asset for United States national security. He has frequently threatened to seize the island through a financial transaction or military force since his return to the Oval Office. The New Republic website has also covered the same story. How does Greenland factor into United States' national security calculations? The Arctic island lies along the shortest route from Europe to North America, making it critical to the U.S. ballistic missile warning system. The United States already has a significant military presence in Greenland through the Pituffik Space Base, which supports missile warning and space surveillance operations for NATO. During the Cold War era, the base served as an early warning post for potential Soviet missile strikes on Europe. Today, it offers a uniquely strategic location for air and submarine surveillance. The United States has made it clear that it wants to expand its military presence on Greenland, with plans to install radars to monitor the waters connecting Greenland, Iceland, and Britain, a gateway frequently traversed by Russian naval ships and nuclear submarines. Acquiring Greenland outright would significantly expand America's Arctic claim, bolstering its influence over the region. But there is certainly more to U.S. interest in Greenland than just security concerns. Economically, Greenland heavily relies on its fishing industry, which accounts for over 95% of exports, and on Denmark's annual subsidies, which cover about half of the island's public budget. In recent years, some Greenlandic politicians have considered a free association with the United States, whereby they would swap Danish subsidies for American support, while maintaining the autonomy similar to arrangements with the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, and Palau. Donald Trump's aggressive stance has disrupted those discussions. About 80% of Greenland is covered with ice, some of it a mile thick. As global warming accelerates Arctic ice melting, the region has become a hotbed of international competition, with the United States vying against rivals for control over its untapped mineral resources and emerging shipping routes. As the ice continues to recede, ironically due to pollution from major emitters like the United States, Greenland's minerals and rare earth metals are becoming even more enticing. A White House official recently stated that Greenland's rare earth minerals, a collection of 25 critical new materials essential for industries ranging from smartphones to weapon systems, are sufficient to power the U.S. economy for the next generation. Part 1.
Seoul, Gangnam District. The streets are dotted with high-rises and congested shopping malls. The streets receive visitors from all across South Korea. But the upscale and famous district is frequented by a special group of women more than any other group. The women go to Gangnam not just for taking a walk or shopping, but for something more important that is supposed to change their own and their family's destiny. Their destination is postpartum care centers. The centers are established especially for new mothers who've recently been discharged from hospitals. They have well-equipped suites with access to nurses and doctors round the clock, sports gyms, massage parlors, training and counseling sessions on infant care. Even the high costs of the services, which surpass several thousand dollars, don't dissuade South Korean mothers. According to unofficial figures, over 50% of South Korean mothers refer to the centers after giving birth to children. Now, they can access the centers all over South Korea and not just in Gangnam. The centers have mushroomed across the country at an astounding rate during the past two decades and have raised serious questions about fertility.
According to data from the Ministry of Health and Welfare, postpartum care centers in
Korea. The first one actually began appearing around 1996 to reach nearly 300 10 years later. And as of last year, there were 510 such centers here in Korea. And on average, about a third, nearly 32% of new mothers in Korea do use the service.
The postpartum care centers in the country do what was called sanhejuri in the past. It was a tradition that belonged to the old Korea to take care of mothers and their children. It took between a week and a month. During this period, women would go to their parents' houses to eat healthy food in order to regain their strength. The centuries-old tradition faced radical changes in the mid-90s. Lifestyle in South Korea underwent huge changes due to the economic crisis and the loans received from the International Monetary Fund. Women had to work for longer hours than before. Employers wouldn't take maternity leave seriously. Families didn't have any time for sanhejuri anymore. That's why postpartum care centers became a lucrative business. The change in lifestyle ruined both sanhejuri and traditional values. As the number of the centers increased, replacement rate decreased. Replacement rate is a number equal to every woman who replaces the number of the deceased population with the new population. In other words, if every woman gives birth to more than two babies in her lifetime, she will make up for the lost population and the population growth will remain steady. The average replacement rate in the world is about 2.1, but South Korea is a special case. Replacement rate in the country has plummeted to an unbelievable figure in recent years, 0.9. It ranks 200th among world countries. Now, South Koreans have been bearing the aftershocks of capitalist views and the consequences of population decline. On the one hand, they have to work for longer hours, and on the other hand, they don't have sufficient time or incentive to make up for the lost population. But South Korea isn't the only country that is grappling with reduced population. A little further afield, in neighboring China, the same problem exists. The country's 1.4 billion strong population is only one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is the trend that started decades ago. When Mao Zedong grabbed power in June 1946, China's population was 550 million. Because of his controversial political and economic plans, the population of the country reached the jaw-dropping figure of 900 million people in 30 years. However, after Mao's death in 1976, the new leaders of the Communist Party adopted a new approach. One of the most important challenges besides the economic and cultural changes was to come up with a solution to control the birth rate. The new leaders in China decided to make an overhaul in family planning policy. So, in late 70s, the media made speculations about one-child policy. Later, it was widely advertised on the streets.
I was born in China in 1985, a time when China's population crisis was making headlines around the world.
There are more than a billion Chinese. That one big statistic, more than anything else, is at the heart of that country's huge economic problems.
By the middle of the next century, if China's families have an average of 3 children, there will be starvation. However, with 1 child per family, the standard of living doubles.
So now there's a desperate effort underway to control the population, to limit families to just 1 child. Chinese officials are using fines, economic incentives, and propaganda. Billboards like this one are up all over the country. They have a long way to go.
Six years before I was born, China launched its one-child policy. I grew up seeing reminders of the policy everywhere. They were painted on the walls, printed on playing cards, calendars, matches, snack boxes. I remembered the plaques the government hung on all the front doors in my village every year, signifying each family's commitment to the Communist Party's values. Each plaque was decorated with stars, indicating how well a family performed, including a star for whether the family had no more than 1 child. Our family always missed that star.
Although some ethnic minorities and rural families were allowed to have 2 children, things weren't satisfactory for other people. The government made birth control and abortion widespread among the citizens. The violators faced harsh punishments. One-child policy was not just a recommendation. Confiscating property, tough penalties, sending the second and third children to nurseries, and mandatory sterilization were the punishments for those who did not follow one-child policy. On the other hand, there were many incentives for the families who had only 1 child, among them monthly cash handouts and the honorary stars of the Communist Party. As time passed, new restrictive rules were introduced and one-child policy was more widely advertised. It seemed the propaganda worked because figures showed the population growth rate had fallen. As the population growth rate plummeted, the economic growth took up the ground at a faster pace. It wasn't the whole story.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Stand here, so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly, I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, let's talk about or delve into some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me begin this episode with this question, Sheikh. Which types of marine animals are halal to eat?
Well, this is a very good question. A lot of people outside the country, Iran, for example, live nearby sea and they want to know about what kind of seafoods are halal for them, or what kind of seafoods they find in the market and they can buy and can consume. That's a pretty important question,
yes.
Of course. According to His Eminence, among the seafoods or the sea animals, only scaled fish are halal, okay? And shrimps are also halal. And
but they're not scaled.
Yeah, they are not scaled. Shrimps are an exception.
Yes.
When we talk of scaled fish, there are many species of scaled fish, okay? And some of the fish might not have scales at the if you look at them, but if you ask the fishermen whether this fish is among the from the category of scaled fish or not,
yes,
they will say, okay, it is from the category of scaled fish. The scales are gone, but they're still considered to be scaled or scaly fish.
Yes.
Therefore, it is permissible to eat and to consume such fish. And let's also tell, I should say that that Sunni Muslims eat non-scaled fish as well. They eat prawns, they eat lobsters, they eat
crabs,
oysters, crabs, and these things. I've been there to many places. I've seen them eating these things. According to them, all of these seafoods are halal.
Mm-hmm.
It's, there could be some exceptions. But Sunni Muslims, okay, it's very much important to make sure that the fish you eat, even if you are living in a Muslim country, it's necessary to make sure that the fish or the seafood you eat is halal, okay? Make sure you do not eat, for example, clams instead of shrimps, lobsters instead of some other kind of sea animals, okay? And scaled fish also, there are many, many varieties of scaled fish, and they are available everywhere.
Yes.
If you live in a non-Muslim country, let's say you live in India, okay? India is a place where you barely find any halal meat, okay? You cannot slaughter cows or any oxen because the Hindus, fearing the Hindus, you cannot slaughter them openly. And
yes,
even you don't have any, for example, beef market,
yes,
there in India, because the Hindus do not allow cows to be slaughtered. So if you want to eat meat because you are starving, okay,
yes,
because of not having meat, so make sure you eat fish instead of beef, okay?
Yes.
Beef is halal in
exactly
itself, but you cannot find it. So in order to just have your some kind of meat, you can eat scaled fish, and even if you get it from a Hindu, that it's okay. It's okay as long as it's scaled, it is halal to eat.
Well, there are two questions that cross my mind, Sheikh.
Yes.
About the scaled fish.
Yeah.
First of all, regarding the scaled fish.
Yeah.
You said that they need to be scaled so that it would be actually open to us. I mean, as halal food,
yes,
right? But, you know, some fish might have scales, but they're only seen with, which we call it, with, you know, some kind of technology,
yeah.
right? Like, for example, microscope or something. Do you mean with naked eyes that you will be able to see the scales and that would make the fish hello?